Thank you, Mrs. Summers, for hosting again. Thank you all for coming. So, last week we talked about the Tanakos, and this week we are going to try to talk about Kriyas Yamsuf and how that comes in. If you were not here last week and you did not listen to the recording yet of last week, fear not, you can still listen to the recording. But I will try to, you know, give a recap of what's relevant to our discussion over here. So let's start, as we always like to do, with a bunch of questions. We know that Klal Yisrael left Mitzrayim on the 15th day of Nisan. Okay, Makas Bechoros happened on the night of the 15th, and Klal Yisrael left on the morning of the 15th, and that is we celebrate the first day of Pesach. As we go through the holiday of Pesach, we have 2 days outside of Eretz Yisrael in the diaspora, but really, it's 1 day, and then we have 6 days in between of, 5 days in between of Chol Hamoed, 5 days of Chol Hamoed, and then we have a seventh day at the end. And what's the seventh day? So Rashi tells us that the seventh day is the day of Kriyas Yamsuf. Rashi tells us that is why we celebrate the seventh day as day of Yom Tov. Again, outside of Eretz Yisrael, we celebrate 2 days. We have the seventh and eighth day, but really it's just the seventh day. If you stop and think about it for a minute, the whole thing, the whole process is very strange. Clients will go out of Mitzrayim. Okay? It should be done. That's it. They go into the desert, they count Sfir 49 days, they come to Har Sinai, they get the Torah, finished, end of story, they live happily ever after. Till the golden calf, you know, but for a while it's nice, and then you have like this blip in between. No, Paro has a change of heart. He's going to chase after Bnei Yisrael. They're going to go down to the Yamsuf, and Hashem says, "I'm not done with Paro yet. I'm going to one final nace to top all the miracles that you've seen until now. That's going to be Kriyas Yamsuf. So just do it." In one shot. I mean, why does it have to be split up, no pun intended, why does it have to be split between the first day and the seventh day? If Hashem has you know, the grand finale, as it were, up his sleeve, so just do it on the night of the 15th, you have Makas Bechoros, and then just do Kriyas Yamsuf right away, or its equivalent in Egypt. Why the break? Why the wait of 7 days? Don't tell me it's, you know, we have to have a 7 day holiday or something to that effect. Okay, maybe we do, but that itself, why the need for like this 2-part redemption process? Okay, that is question number one. Question number two: Bnei Yisrael get to the Yamsuf and they're boxed in. And they start to daven. Rashi says, "Tafsu b'umnes avaysom." They grab the profession of their forefathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and they pray to Hashem. Okay, very nice. They prayed. What does Hashem tell Moshe? This is not a time for prayer. Daber alam v'yiso. Just tell everyone to just go right into the sea. Just jump right in. I'm taking care of this. Now is not a time for prayer. Okay. What do you mean? Not a time for prayer. What do you do? I think I mentioned this last week already. What do you do if not pray? I mean, whenever there's a problem, you daven to Hashem, right? When's the last time? Oh, there's something terrible happening. We have to go jump in the lake. No, you don't jump in the lake. You go to shul and you daven. You call your friends together and you have a tehillim group. That's what you do when there's a problem. I mean, this is not a time to daven. Jump in the sea. Since when, you know, since when is that the approach? The approach is always to daven. Even more strange, is that the Medrash says that Hashem specifically put Bnei Yisrael into this predicament because he's mis'avel l'tfilas and he desires their prayers. So Hashem put them into this mess that they should daven. So Hashem says, I really want you to daven. Here's a big mess. Daven. Okay, we're davening. No, forget that. Jump into the sea. what in the world is going on over here? Okay, let's just take it one step further. If you analyze, and if you go through the psukim and the Rashis and the different statements of Chazal, which a lot of you have probably seen or heard over the course of time, you will notice something very, very strange over here. Hashem tells Moshe to tell Bnei Yisrael to deliberately turn around and make it look like they're lost in the desert. Why? Paro should see and say, oh, Nevuchim Heim Ba'aretz, they're lost in the desert. And Paro says, oh, they're lost. I'm going to go chase after them. This is my opportunity. I'm going to go bring them back to Egypt. So Hashem
this is before they get to
the sea. Yeah. Yes, Hashem kind of sets Paro up, right? It's a sting operation. Hashem is going to set Paro up, that Paro is going to look and say, oh, they're lost. I could go and recapture them. And so Hashem tells Bnei Israel, I don't want you to just flee Paro and be done with it. We're going to have some fun with this over here. You're going to make it look like you're lost. Paro is going to give chase. You're going to come to the Yam Suf, and if he comes with Paro v'chol chelo, I will be glorified through Paro and his entire army. Bnei Israel say, Hashem, you're the boss. No problem. That's what we're doing. Yeah, we're going to listen to you, we're going to listen to Moshe, and we're going to do that. They come to the Yam Suf, they turn to Hashem. Okay, Hashem, we follow instructions. Let's split the Yam Suf, and the Yam Suf is 1 second. Not so fast. You're Oivde Avoid Zara, and the Egyptians are Oivde Avoid Zara. We can't, the Yam says, he says, I can't just split. Hashem says, 1 second. This is a little more complicated than I thought. I thought this would be simple, but the Yam doesn't want to split. Rashi says, Bnei Israel were in a state of judgment at that moment. Are they going to survive this? Are they not going to survive this? 1 second. You told me to do this. This was part of the plan, right? We're going down to the Yam Suf. Power's going to chase us. Then you're going to save us. It's going to be this whole big grand finale, this great covenant for Hashem. And then when we get there, Hashem says, I forgot you guys worshipped Avodah Zarah in Mitzrayim. It just comes back to the same question of what is going on? What is this? Was this supposed to happen? It wasn't supposed to happen. Was this a mess which Bnei Israel willingly got themselves into? And then only to find that Hashem really put them into a mess, and it's not so simple for them to get themselves out of the mess. How are we to understand the whole series of events over here in terms of whether or not Bnei Israel were willingly part of this plan or whether they were forced into it? And to the extent that they're willingly part of it, it doesn't seem fair that they should suddenly be told this is not so simple. And to the extent that it's not so simple, why would they have willingly put themselves into that mess? So how are we to understand it? Was it a given that they would be saved? Is it not a given that they are to be saved? How do we look at the whole series of events of Kriyas Yam Suf? One more thing just to point out in terms of Kriyas Yam Suf and the Shira, you see a refrain that repeats itself in the Shira, in the song that Bnei Israel sing after the Yam splits, after the sea splits, and that's that there's a big focus on the future. Az Yashir Moshe, then Moshe will sing. Rashi says, Chazal Pana Yashir, he will sing. The Mikan Remez Lechias Hameis Meltar, here we have an allusion to the resurrection of the dead in the Torah, because Yashir is in the future. Then Moshe will sing in the future, and that's an allusion to Tchias Hameis, to the resurrection. How does the resurrection find itself in middle of Shiras Hayam, in middle of the Song of the Sea? How does that get here? Another thing about the future, again, only at the end of the Shira, of the song, Klal Yisrael say, Hashem yimloch le'olam void. Hashem will reign forever in the future tense. And Chazal comment, the sages comment, that it says, had they said Hashem melech, Hashem reigns in the present tense forever, then they would have merited to experience the final redemption. Because they said Hashem will reign in the future, so they did not merit the final redemption, they would have to wait for it into the future. Okay, so why didn't they say Hashem Melech? If it's just a question of semantics, so say Hashem Melech. What is the big deal? You find a similar thing, parenthetically, by Chizkiah HaMelech. King Chizkiah, after Sancheirib, the Assyrian general's forces, are miraculously defeated. Okay, they're at the gates of Sancheirib, the Assyrian general, and his forces are at the gates of Jerusalem, and all hope looks lost, and Chizkiah HaMelech, King Hezekiah, he comes and he tells everyone, go into the Beis Medrash, everyone learn. The Gemara says he stuck a sword into the opening of the Beis Medrash. Haven't tried that in yeshiva yet to see if it works, but he said anyone who wants to leave will have to deal with this sword. Okay, everyone goes in and learns. Chizkiah says, we're not doing anything. Hashem is taking care of us. That night, all of the troops die. They wake, and they simply don't wake up in the morning. Sancheirib is defeated miraculously by angels of Hashem who come and kill his army overnight. And Chizkiah Melech writes a letter expressing the great thanks he has to Hashem for this miracle, but he does not sing Shira. And Chazal tells us, had he sang Shira, would he have sung Shira, he would have merited to be Mashiach. He is a sign of the house of David. He's the king he's the king of from Shevet Yehuda. Because he didn't sing Shira, he does not merit to become Melech HaMashiach, to become the Messiah. So again, the question when you see these kinds of things is, okay, so why didn't he just sing Shira? Like, why didn't he sing Shira? He was too lazy. He had a plane to catch. Like, why couldn't he sing Shira? So let's try to understand again what the purpose of the splitting of the sea was, what its impact was, and I think we'll try to answer all the questions. I always manage to forget a couple of them by the time I get to the end. But if you remember them and I forget them, please feel free to remind me. Okay. We discussed last week the idea that the ten makos are the means of transition from a world of nature to a world of supernatural. That the world before Klai Yisrael went out of Mitzrayim, even in the time of the Avos, of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, was a world where they related to Hashem through the natural world. Okay, but they did not experience HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hashem beyond the natural world, only through the natural world. Okay, so even the miracles that they experienced in their lives were with somehow, again, within the framework of the natural world. Avraham was saved from the fire? Yes, he was. Is that natural? In a certain sense, yes. The Malach Gavriel saves him. The Malach Gavriel is in charge of fire. In other words, within the framework of natural world of how fire operates, Avraham did not deserve to be burned by the fire. Okay, that's within the framework of nature. If you wanted to say it in one sentence, nature is cause and effect. It's cause and effect, right? If you prick a finger, it's going to bleed. If a person takes cyanide, they're going to die. If a person exercises, they're going to have a healthy heart. If they don't and they eat, too much saturated fats, they're not going to be. There's a cause and effect system in place, right? Sun rises in the east, it sets in the west, et cetera, cause and effect. You can expect it to go on that way. Supernatural is cause and effect breaks down. The ultimate cause is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And all bets are off. We discussed last week the idea of Purim is the Goyrel, is the lottery. The lottery is the ultimate within nature. There's no cause and effect. The Venahapachu, the turnover was that Haman said, the world is as random as can be. There's no God running anything. And so the ultimate randomness that you could display in nature is a lottery, is a raffle, is a Goyrel. Okay? And Hashem says, no, you're making a big mistake. What you think is the ultimate randomness is really going to be the cause of me putting everything together. In other words, you go from one extreme to the other. You thought it was ultimate random. On the contrary, there is nothing natural about it, and yet everything falls into place, because ultimately who's calling the shots? Hashem himself. There's no natural cause and effect, and yet everything's perfect. How did that happen? Okay, the answer is, because there's the ultimate cause and effect beyond the natural world. That's Purim. That's why it's called Purim. Al Shem HaPur, because of the lots. That is the ultimate description of the holiday. And so Pesach is the transition from the world of the natural to the world of the supernatural. How did that happen? Through 10 plagues. 10 plagues are a breakdown of each of the 10 utterances, the Asar Ma'amaris, through which Hashem created the world. Those are 10 layers of natural world, and each of the makos parallels backwards one of the 10 statements. And so Mitzrayim had created a world totally locked into nature. Hashem is going to destroy them one by one. Bnei Yisrael are going to escape that prison of the natural world of Egypt. They're going to go out into the desert. They're going to go to Sinai, where Hashem is going to give Aseres HaDibros, Torah. Aseres HaDibros is a world of the natural, but there's Hashem on top saying, this is what you do, Aseres HaDibros. And so, it's a rebuilt world where the nature is not locked into nature. You can move beyond it, and that's the idea of Torah. Torah precedes the world. And so that is the process. We go from the world of natural to the world of supernatural. At Sinai, the 10 plagues are the means of breaking down the natural and getting Klai Yisrael out. Okay, that is the synopsis of last week's class. I still recommend that you listen to the recording to get the whole story. Yeah, go ahead.
Is having Nevuah, is that natural, part of the natural world?
Not really. I would have to say yes, right, because Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov did. To some degree, yes, the Nevuah of Moshe was not. The Nevuah of everyone else is to some degree locked within the natural. Okay? Which is why any Navi, when he has a Nevuah, has to go into a trance. Because he has to move beyond his physical self. Moshe has already moved beyond it, so he can have a conversation with Hashem without leaving his physical self behind. Okay? So they're still to some degree locked into it. Okay? If I have time, if you remind me if I have time, unlikely, but if I have time, I'll try to go back and talk about that more. There's a lot more to be said about that.
Okay.
What?
Or
another class. Right. Okay. Next. I'm sure everyone's available next Monday night. I'm sure. Right? Okay. You'd rather do it, but it's not. Listen, if you believe in supernatural, it'll just happen on its own. Okay. Where's the sorcerer's apprentice when you need him? Okay. So. Okay. Here was the problem with going out of Mitzrayim. And I mentioned this briefly last week. Bnei Yisrael really left early. We mentioned this idea last week. They were supposed to stay longer. They couldn't. They had to leave early. Okay. You see this in a certain sense very strongly when it comes time for Bnei Yisrael to leave. And Hashem tells Moshe, please speak to Bnei Yisrael and tell them to borrow vessels and clothing and garments from their Egyptian neighbors when they leave, to take the money with them. Why? Says Rashi, why does he say, please beg them. I need you to do this. Because I promised Avram that they'll leave with great wealth. And if they don't leave with great wealth, Avram's going to complain. He's going to say, hey, you fulfilled the promise of slavery. You didn't fulfill the promise of great wealth. That's not fair. Okay? A longer discussion about what exactly that means. We don't have time for everything now. Exactly what does it mean? Hashem only has to fulfill his promise that Avram shouldn't complain. Otherwise not. Okay? But what is interesting about this plea from Hashem is that Hashem says, Moshe, tell him to borrow it. To borrow it. Now, the simple understanding is, well, you borrow it because if you go to the Egyptian neighbor and say, I'm taking that nice silver candelabra over there, I'm going to use it Friday night, So I'm taking it. They're going to say, no. So they didn't say I'm taking it, they say I'm borrowing it. I'll bring it back in 3 days, And so the Egyptian neighbor at least feels, like they're not giving it away. It makes it easier for them to part with it. That's the simple understanding. Okay? But yet you see in other places that that's not such a simple answer because it seems like the Egyptians wanted the Jews out of there. And Rashi says that the Egyptians said, don't just take one. Take everything. Just take it and get out. Okay? You kind of have, this is not my discussion now, you do have kind of contradictory indications as to the eagerness of the Egyptians to hand everything over to the Jewish people, because elsewhere it says that during the plague of darkness they snooped around so that when the Egyptians said, I don't have a silver leichter, at least not the one you're looking for. How many kids do you have? You had 6 kids in one shot, so what do you have, 24 kids? I'm fresh out of 24 branch candelabrums this week. No, I saw it. It was in your tiding in your closet over there. So did they want to give it? Did they not want to give it? I'm not sure. But it seems like there wasn't eagerness to give it, yet they have to borrow it, specifically borrow it. So what's the idea of borrowing? And so, on a deeper level, the Mefarshim say, Rav Gedalia Shor talks about this, Bnei Yisrael, in a sense, really didn't deserve this redemption right now. In a sense, they borrowed it. When you borrow something, you get to use it, and then you have to return it. It's not really yours. It's not really yours, right? I want to take a spin in your car, in your Jaguar. Yeah, I'll drive around the block. That was exciting. It's nice. It's not really mine, but I had the experience, and now I hand it back. That's it. So Pesach, the first night of Pesach, when Bnei Yisrael went out of Mitzrayim, they really weren't on the level to be redeemed from Egypt yet. They really weren't pulled out. They weren't menutik. They were not fully disconnected from Egypt, from the morass of Egyptian society and culture and all the impurity that was there. They were not fully out of it yet. You see this very clearly because it says, what is the parasha? Begin. Vayihi b'shalach paros om. When Paro sent Bnei Yisrael. What do you mean when I send somebody? When I send you, that means you are connected to me. Right? If I say, get out, and I just kick you out, and I have nothing more to do with you. Now, Paro told Klal Yisrael, get out. And yet, the pasuk says, vayihi b'shalach, when he sent them. Send, when I send someone, that means I have a connection to them. There's a connection. It's a shiluach. Vayihi b'shalach, the Mefarshim say that Paro accompanied them. When you accompany someone, you are connecting with them. Okay, that's the idea. When you have a guest, you're supposed to accompany them, is to maintain that connection, and your spiritual connection stays with the guest along the way. So it's a means of connection. So Paro sent Bnei Yisrael out, but he's still connected with them. Mitzrayim is still part and parcel of Bnei Yisrael. And that's a deeper reason why the pasuk says, Hashem did not want to take them through the land of the Philistines. V'lenochem elokim derech eretz plishtim. Hashem didn't want to take them through the land of the Philistines. Kikarovu, because it's nearby. So the verse continues. The pasuk says, when they see war, they'll turn around and they'll run back to Egypt. Okay? But There are commentaries that say, again, on a deeper level, the idea of the land of the Pelishtim being nearby is spiritually. Spiritually, the land of the Pelishtim is the bridge between Egypt and Eretz Canaan, and the land of Canaan. It's a bridge. Still is today. The land of Pelishtim is none other than Gaza, at least a good part of it. You have all these wonderful people either sneaking into Israel or sneaking into Egypt. Okay? And they're kind of the bridge. So the land of the Philistines, the Pelishtim, emerge, without going into all the details, they are a product of Mitzrayim. Their lineage has Egypt in them, but they live in Eretz Yisrael. The Pelishtim are a connection. They have the impurity of Egypt. If Bnei Yisrael leave Mitzrayim and go through a land of Pelishtim that's connected to Egypt, then you don't get out of somewhere only to go back in again. Right? If someone quits smoking, you don't send them into a cigar shop. Right, and say, oh, why don't you hang out here for a while, right? Or someone wants to quit drinking, you don't send them off to the liquor store. So Hashem's not going to take Bnei Israel out of Mitzrayim only to bring them through the land of the Philistines, which is spiritually close to Egypt on their way to the land of Israel. It's too easy to go back. They have to pull themselves out. So they go through the desert instead. The desert is a place where they're going to have to subsist on nothing and no one but HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's no food, there's no water, there's no nothing. They have to go out and they're going to have to rely on Hashem. Hashem is going to take care of them, and this is where they're going to work on pulling themselves out of Egypt. And what they're going to have to do is get themselves to a point where what they borrowed is now going to incorporate itself into them and become part and parcel of them. You could borrow something, and then over time, you shouldn't steal it, but the idea of borrowing is it's yours, I'm just borrowing it, it's not really mine. Or I can have something, and over time I can gradually incorporate it and make it more and more part of myself, and it becomes mine. Yeah.
Why is it not considered stealing?
It was payment for their work. They owe them quite a bit.
Yeah, but the neighbors, the people who they borrowed from.
Or why didn't they just say, can you pay us?
Can you pay us?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a very lengthy discussion about what exactly they were taking out of Egypt, and the idea that the money they were taking wasn't just money, but it was the spiritual potential latent in that money. Okay. Let me try to do this fast. let's try to do this quickly. I didn't want to get into this, but we'll try to do it quickly. Why does Avraham Avinu care about money? Hashem tells Avraham Avinu, they'll leave, they're going to be rich. Avraham says, okay, that's okay now. And if Hashem doesn't fill, Hashem says, Avraham comes back to Hashem and said, you promised to make them rich. Since when is Avraham Avinu concerned with wealth? Why is this such a big deal? Why is there such a focus on this?
Okay. So where are they going to use their money in the desert?
Oh, for the Mishkan.
Like,
but let me. Well, it was gold, it was silver, it was garments. Let me get this point exactly this point, huh? In other words, when Hashem gives a person wealth, possessions, goods, is it a means just to be ostentatious and show off how much I have, how rich and fancy and how much pleasure I can have out of it? Of course not, right? It's a means towards serving Hashem, towards glorifying Hashem, which ultimately realizes its purpose in the Mishkan, right? Along the way, a funny thing happened along the way to the Mishkan. They made a golden calf out of it. And Moshe came to Hashem, Chazal say, and he said, Hashem, it's your fault. You gave them all this gold. What do you expect them to do with it? The Gemara says that Moshe told Hashem, it's like taking a teenager, and you give him a lot to eat and a lot to drink, and you take a purse, and you hang it around his neck, and you take him leave him in the red light district of town. What do you think is going to happen? That's exactly what it says. Well, it doesn't say red light district, but yeah. That's exactly what it says. Okay? What do you expect to happen? Now, what does that mean? So now let's backtrack. What it means is like this. Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim, and it says Vayinatzlu. Vayinatzlu means they emptied it out to the depths. Vayinatzlu is Mitzrayim. They emptied it out. Rashi says they left it like the depths of the sea that have no fish in it. It's empty. There's nothing there. I know. Don't ask me about all the fish they found in the depths of the sea. I have no idea. Ask that deep sea angler. I don't know. Good question. It's like there's nothing left. In other words, Mitzrayim has Kedusha in it. There are sparks of holiness in Egypt. I'm never going to get to my main point. But anyways, there are sparks of holiness in Egypt. The Jewish people come into Egypt. Okay, they're going to go through a period of gullus in order at the end they will be on a level where they could pull all that Kedusha with them, take it out with them, and reconnect it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is in the form of wealth, of possessions. of money. Who got that money originally? Where did Egypt become so wealthy from? There was a guy named Joseph, years earlier, who becomes the ruler, Hu HaShalot, Hu HaMashbir. Yosef is the Tzaddik Yisod Olam. Yosef is the one who's supporting the entire world. Yosef is the Tzaddik Yisod Olam. He's the foundation of the world. He's the one supporting the entire world. Everything here is because of Yosef. Yosef is the connection between heaven and earth. He's the conduit between heaven and earth. Everything comes through Yosef. And really, this is all Yosef's money. Yosef died. Pyro confiscated it. He gave it. Eventually, all the Egyptians got it. Bnei Israel, after going through the Golas process, ought to have been at the level where they could reclaim what was rightfully theirs. Are the Egyptians going to part with it easily? No. They're not. And in fact, there are those who say in the beginning of Parshas Shemot, when it says, I'm trying to remember the pasuk. Okay, whatever it is, at one point the Egyptians say that they'll become more mighty than us. Okay, and the idea there are commentators that say that the idea is we have all these sparks of holiness. Okay, this is very very Kabbalistic ideas, but it's ours. We use it for our purposes, but the Jewish people are going to take it away from us, and that's terrible. You ever notice, by the way, that wherever the Jews go, that nation is successful? Right? So some will have you believe because the Jews are brighter, the better business heads, that may be true. But you know, if you believe in a God, the idea is that Hashem takes care of his people. And wherever the Jews go, they you know, Hashem takes care of them and sends them what they need. There's this idea of pulling the sparks out of a place. Wherever you are in life, wherever you end up, there's always work to be done there. There's always sparks of holiness. If you end up in a place and you have no clue why you're there, I think Rabbi Summers once told me a story. He ended up somewhere. I remember all the details. Maybe you know better than I. He ended up somewhere. He got lost. He ended up somewhere, and he ended up maybe by a Jewish cemetery or something, and he died in there. I don't remember all the details. But you know, the point being that sometimes Hashem leads you, and you're like, why in the world am I here? Why did I miss my flight and I'm stuck in Copenhagen, you know, for a day or two because I missed my next flight? Who knows? It's not just to sit there and stare up at the ceiling. You know, pull out a sefer and learn. Say daven, say something to Hillel, do something positive, because there's a good chance Hashem put you there for that purpose. You know, I mean, it doesn't. Not every one of these stories makes it into the next Pesach Kron book. Some of them do. You know, but you know, but not everything, you know, ends up in the story in this world. But in the big book up there, there's a story to be told. So Bnei Israel have taken all this money. The problem is they didn't reach the level to merit it. Money's a dangerous thing. And if you're not at the level, instead of you pulling the money up, the money pulls you down. And so Bnei Yisrael, Chazal tell us, when they left Egypt, it's like a prisoner going out of prison. He says, I don't want it. And you say, hang around another day or two, and we'll give you lots of money when you get out of the prison. He says, keep the money. Just get me out of here. Okay? In other words, Bnei Yisrael said, we're not at the level to take this money. Because we haven't reached that level of perfection yet. We have to leave too soon. And so, yes, we'd love to take all this money, all this kedusha out and use it properly, but we're not at that level. And Hashem says, I promised Avram, you have to do it. And you'll have to make it work. And Bnei Israel will say, okay, fine, we'll do it. We'll take it out. And Lamaisa, ultimately what happened? It pulled them down. They had a sin of the golden calf. They fixed it. They rectified it with the Mishkan. All that money went to the Mishkan. The Mishkan was the rectification of the golden calf. But it wasn't all, you know, it wasn't all wonderful. It wasn't all roses for a while. You know, it and we're still suffering from the effects today. But they had to leave early. Okay, so it wasn't so much an idea of stealing the money. Back to your question. I'm sorry, but that's the back to your question of why did they have to steal it. Both of your questions. Why do they have to steal it? Yeah? The answer is, it's not a question of stealing, borrowing. The point is, they have to take these sparks of Kedusha out of Egypt via the money. So it's not just like you owe me money for payment. That's the technical reason of why the money is theirs. But on a deeper level, it's they're pulling all of this stuff out of Egypt. That's why the Pasuk says, that Hashem says, the Pasuk says that every woman asked, Isha Mishchenta, Migras Besa, and a person asked, May Re'ehu, from his friend. Usually the term Re'ehu is limited to two Jews interacting with each other. You don't find the term Re'ehu usually between a Jew and a non-Jew. That level of relationship doesn't exist. Re'ehu as friends. Except when there's something very Jewish contained in that place. In other words, if there's Kedusha that has to be pulled from that non-Jewish source, then it becomes Re'ehu. Okay? Another Another place where you find this is that Yaakov tells Laban, time for me to go. Laban says, maybe stay. Yaakov says, okay, fine, I'll stay. Right? Why did Yaakov decide to stay? Because Yaakov said, if Laban wants me to stay, that means there's still something inside Laban that's attracted to me. Bad people don't like good people. Okay? So Yaakov said, if Laban wants me to stay, that means there's still some goodness left in that I have to pull out. And so Yaakov hung around. When did Yaakov leave? When he sees that Laban doesn't like him anymore. The pasuk says he saw that Laban's not looking at him nicely anymore. He's upset with him. Yaakov says, it's all done. Whatever I have to pull out from him, I pulled out, and now all that's left is the bad. And that's why he doesn't want me anymore. Now I could go. So that's the idea of pulling all that money out of Egypt. More about that later if we have time. Because at the Yom Sof, we know they got much more money at the Yom. Getting back to the Yom. The Jewish people have not really earned this. They've borrowed it. The verse that is often quoted in the context of going out of Egypt is called Doidi Hinei Zeba Medalek Alehoren Mekapetzel Hagavos. The voice of my beloved is coming. Medalek, it's jumping. It's skipping. Al Haharim, Mekapetz, it's again jumping on the hills. The idea of jumping and skipping is something ahead of time. When you jump, you are doing something not within the normal constraints. Usually you walk somewhere. When you jump forward, when you skip, you are covering a much greater ground than should be within that small period of time. The idea of jumping is something ahead of itself, where something is getting ahead of itself. Hashem jumped ahead. Kol Doidi, the voice of my beloved, is jumping over the mountains, is skipping over the hills. The idea is that Hashem is coming early to get Klal Yisrael out, because they have to get out now. If not now, then never. But really, it's borrowed. They haven't really incorporated it into themselves. They now have a period of 5 days, maybe six, we'll see in a second, to incorporate that into themselves. Okay, and then is going to come the final showdown between Bnei Yisrael and Egypt, where Bnei Yisrael are going to finally rid themselves of Egypt. And Moshe tells Bnei Yisrael, you see Egypt today, you will never see them again. That's what Moshe tells Bnei Yisrael at the Yam. You see them today, you will not see them again. In other words, this event of crossing the Yam Suf is going to be the event which will sever any connection you have with the Egyptians. And that's, in a sense, why the Torah says we are never supposed to go back to Egypt. We completely severed our connection. When you go to a place, it's because you have work there to do. Egypt is done. We're done with Egypt. Whatever work was there to be done, we did. We emptied it out. We took everything out of there. We're done with Egypt. You're going to say, the Rambam lived in Egypt. Good question. The Rambam himself had that question on himself. But you're really not supposed to be. It's not simple. It's a lot of talk about how Jews can live in Egypt. But really, we're done with Egypt. You're done with them. Where does that happen in Kriyas Yam Suf? What do they have in between? So here's a very fascinating idea. Pesach is referred to as a Shabbos. Where do you have Pesach referred to as a Shabbos? Mimocharas HaShabbos. We say you begin counting Sfira the day after Shabbos. Now, Pesach is not Shabbos at all. If any holiday is close to Shabbos, it's Yom Kippur. Pesach is not close to Shabbos at all. How is it similar to Shabbos? In what ways is it similar to Shabbos? So one aspect of it is, Shabbos comes whether you're ready or not. Don't we all know that? Okay? You know, Yom Tov, okay, I can finish the cooking after I light the candles, you know, whatever, you know, so it's not quite done yet, you know, but, okay? But Shabbos is coming whether you like it or not. You don't do anything for Shabbos. I mean, you do, but in terms of the Kedusha coming, it comes on its own. Right? Yom Tov is up to us. We, Klal Yisrael, through Beis Din as our representatives, we sanctify the month, and that is how the Yom Tov comes in. We are the ones who sanctify the month and by extension the holidays. Shabbos is Hashem created the world, Hashem rested, Shabbos comes on its own. Shabbos comes on its own without us doing anything. And Pesach, the Geula, the redemption from Egypt, came on its own. The Jewish people didn't really deserve it. And so there's an element of Shabbos in Pesach. Okay, the element of Shabbos, you're going to say, well, Pesach is going to come whether I'm ready or not in terms of the cleaning also. So you have that connection. So Shabbos comes whether you're ready or not because Hashem gives it to you. Hashem bestows that sanctity. You don't bring the sanctity in, it comes on its own. Yom Tov is not like that, and Pesach has this element of Hashem providing it. So here is a very, very fascinating idea. The Gemara has the following question. If a person is lost in the desert, and he lost track of the days of the week. So he wants to keep Shabbos. He doesn't know what day of the week Shabbos is. He can't keep Shabbos every day. It's not practical. It's not possible. What should one do? What should one do? So the Gemara cites two opinions. One opinion is you keep the first day of Shabbos and then count 6 days, and then the seventh day of Shabbos. You're all nodding your heads. This happened to you recently?
No, we already heard it.
Oh, you heard this question? Okay. I'll just say quickly. You heard it in connection with. Do you remember? You heard it in connection with Pesach, or just in general?
I read it in connection to Shabbos because there's so much mention of Shabbos.
There's so much
in the parsha with.
Shabbos. So you're talking about that idea. Okay, so you let me know if you heard this right. I won't elaborate a lot. I'll just say it fast.
I never.
Okay, so either you count Shabbos. So you count Shabbos. You keep Shabbos, then you count 6 days. The other thing is you count 6 days and then you keep Shabbos. Okay. And the Gemara says, what's the difference? Well, from Hashem's perspective, Hashem created the world in 6 days and then he made Shabbos. From Adam's perspective, he had Shabbos. He was created right before Shabbos. He had Shabbos and then he counted 6 days. What's the idea? Obviously, both elements are true, and here is the idea. Hashem gives you a Shabbos. Did you do anything for it? No, it comes on its own. You're supposed to take that Shabbos, take the sanctity, go out into the week, and then build on it until the next week. It's not a straight line. It's an ascension. You go up, and then you come back to Shabbos again. Some say it's like a spiral, right? You come back to the same point in the spiral, but one floor up the following week. And so you've taken last week's Shabbos into the week. You've built that whole week. 6 weeks you'll do your work. This is in a spiritual sense. And then you bring that into the next Shabbos. And then that Shabbos is one step higher. And then you take that Shabbos and take it out into the next thing. And so in the same sense on Pesach, Hashem takes the Jewish people out of Egypt. From the 49th level of impurity, bang, just straight out. And we discussed last week this sudden transition from a world of nature into a world of where there's no more natural. It's all broken down. Makas Pachoros, the last of the 10 layers is broken down. Bnei Israel are out of this stuck, are out of the prison that they're stuck in of the natural world, and they come out. Okay? But it's a freebie. It's borrowed. It's not really something that they've earned and incorporated into themselves. Okay? It's just like this thing that is thrust upon them momentarily and they really don't have a connection with. And then Hashem says, okay, now you have 6 days to incorporate it into yourself. And let's see where you're holding on day seven. And when day seven comes, they have to have reached a point where they've made it a part of themselves. And that's when they're going to have the opportunity to sever all links to Egypt. Can you really incorporate into yourself, severing your ties with the old world, with Teva, with the natural, with Egypt, which is the ultimate symbol, the ultimate place of being locked into the natural world, where they don't look to heaven at all, where they have everything right there in the little box, and their Nile River provides all their needs. They don't have to look to heaven for rain. Can you do that? And then you're going to come to day seven, the next Shabbos, the next day of Yom, the next Yom Tov, and you're going to take everything you've worked on, and now you're going to come into Shabbos with everything you've worked on, and you have the next Shabbos where you can reach the next level, where you can make it a part of yourself. That is day seven. Now, when I saw this idea, I said, one second, something's off over here. Because normally you have Shabbos, then you have 6 days, then you have a Shabbos. Here you have Pesach, 5 days of Chol Hamoed, better not be six, 5 days of Chol Hamoed, thank you very much. And it's a little bit easier for the parents this year, right? Because you don't have to entertain the kids only, I think, for 1 day. Is when it ends up, right?
Thursday.
What? Is that it? Thursday, yeah. That's it. the rest of the time you're either cooking or eating. Okay, so.
Right.
Oh.
You're right.
We're going to a shir. Okay, so. We're learning. But, so. So I asked this question to myself. I said, it's 5 days. It's not 6 days. I'm not sure the answer. I think the answer might be as follows. Okay, this is. As a parenthetical idea, Bnei Yisrael, when did Makas Bechoros happen? Midnight, at night. Okay, by the morning they were free already, so they had already received that gift from Hashem on the night. When do we have the Seder? When do we experience at night? Right, the Korban Pesach has to be at night. By daybreak, it's all over. They're already out. So the daytime is already the beginning of the process. When does the sea split? So the pasuk says that the wind blew the whole night, and in the morning. Rashi says, Bnei Yisrael, Rashi points out, Bnei Yisrael went into the Yam in the morning. In the morning, they went into the Yam Suf. So if you do the math, you have 7 periods of 24 hours from the morning of day 1 of Pesach till the morning of day 7, you have 7 complete days. That's a theory I have. I'm not sure. This is my theory that you end up with seven complete days. Okay, I'm not sure, but in order, so you have bang that flash of Yetzias Mitzrayim, that present from Hashem, that pulling Klal Yisrael out, the borrowing, that here it is for a little while, see what you can do with it, make it a part of yourself. Then you have seven periods of 24 hours until the morning when they jump in to the Yam and the Yam splits. So that's the work. There's a two-step process over here in terms of Bnei Yisrael going into the Yam Suf and making it split. Because if you look at the beginning, right before the Shir, we said every day is part of davening. Right before Oz Yashir, we say that Bnei Yisrael saw Vayarim as Rameis al Tzvas Yam, Vayiru Ha'omes Hashem, and the people feared Hashem, Vayaminu Ba'Hashem Moshe Avdo, and they believed in Hashem and Moshe's servant. So there's two things in the pasuk over here. There's they feared Hashem, and they believed in Moshe and Hashem and Moshe's servant. So let's examine these two elements. They feared Hashem, and they believed in Hashem and Moshe and Hashem and Moshe's servant. What are these two steps?
The
people feared Hashem, and they believed in Hashem and in Moshe his servant. Vayaminu b'Hashem u'b'Moshe avdo. Right, and they believed in Hashem and in Moshe his servant. Yira, fear, is the idea of an awe. Thank you. Okay, is a better word. Yeah. Yira is the means of incorporating something, making it yours. The Gemara says, "Akol b'day shemayim, chutz miyira shemayim." Everything is by heaven except for fear, awe of heaven, fear of heaven. Okay. The idea being that everything could be given to you as a gift, but not awe of Hashem. Awe of Hashem is something you have to incorporate into yourself on your own. Okay? Awe is what puts things into its place. Ava, love, is on the contrary. Love does not have parameters at all. Ava mikalkalas as Ashura. Ava breaks down the normal lines. People who are in a state of either rage or love will do crazy things. Okay? Right? Kacha. That's how it is. Okay? It doesn't have boundaries. What keeps things in boundaries is the idea of awe. In other words, awe is the ability of your intellect, of your seichel, to keep things in line, and to the extent that you've incorporated into yourself, you're able to keep, when a person gets angry or when a person gets passionate, they could spill over. Your intellect, that's really where the idea of fear of awe of Yira is what keeps things in line, in bounds, make sure that it doesn't spill over, it doesn't go too far. Okay, so Bnei Yisrael got this blast of love from Hashem on Pesach, but it's, you know, it comes and goes very, very, very quickly, right? Yes, when all the I pointed this out very often, just all the Disney movies, right? The hero and heroine ride off into the sunset at the end, infatuated with each other, and then like 6 months later, you know, they're fighting with each other, but they don't show you that part, you know. Then they part ways and they move on, unless there's a sequel. But you know, because you know they saw each other, they liked each other for an hour and a half of the movie, and then it ends, and then what? Okay, then they're on the cover of, you know, the magazines in the rack over there having a fight and getting divorced. Okay, so in other words, the point is, it's very flighty, it's very fleeting. It's very fleeting. A real relationship, a real marriage, a real relationship doesn't happen in the span of a week, of a month. It's built gradually over time. And the longer the relationship is built, the more meaningful and the closer the two people become. Okay, that's a meaningful relationship. It's incorporated because ultimately, if it's just the momentary passions, those fade away. They don't last forever, okay? But when it's done with intellect, when it's done with seichel, when it's done properly, when there are guidelines, and so on and so forth, then the ava, the passion, finds its place within a framework where it can continue, where it can last, but it has to have a framework. And that's the idea of Yira. Bnei Yisrael had to incorporate that blast of love from Hashem. It was a gift. It was a momentary gift. They had to incorporate it into themselves by creating a framework and a structure within themselves to make it a part and parcel of themselves. Okay? Where do we always find the idea of Yira expressed, of awe of fear, is always connected to tefillah, to avoda, service of Hashem. Yitzchak is the paradigm of Yira, of awe of Hashem. Okay, and he's also the paradigm of serving Hashem. He's the one who's the sacrifice. The sacrifice is the ability of a person to completely limit oneself, completely give oneself up. It's not the passion of I want to give for you. It's I will nullify myself and completely give up myself. It's the complete limitation. Okay? And so tefillah, prayer, is always the idea of putting things in their place, nullification of self, bounding, putting boundaries in things. The first step B'nai Yisrael had to do to get to the Yamsuf was to recognize that they had to incorporate into themselves what their forefathers had within themselves. They came to the Yamsuf, and the Medrash says that they looked here and they looked there, and they said, there's nothing left for us to do. We can't go forward. We can't go backwards. In front of us is the sea, and back of us are the Egyptians. To the right and the left is the desert. There's nowhere for us to go. What are we going to do? Upwards. We have to look to Hashem. In other words, they looked at the natural world, and within the natural world they said, we can't succeed here. We have to turn to Hashem. We have no choice. We can't do it on our own. We can't go forward, we can't go back, we can't fight, there's nothing for us to do. We have no choice but to give ourselves up to Hashem. They came to a point where within the natural world they realized, we did what we could, and now we have to turn to Hashem, and our success is dependent upon Hashem. That is, they were able to incorporate within themselves the reality that they have to turn to Hashem. But this is within the framework of the natural world. We can't go forward, we can't go back, we can't go to the right, we can't go to the left. That's all within the natural world. The Gemara says, person who wants to succeed in business, the Gemara says, ultimately, you have to engage in business and daven to Hashem. So the Gemara says, it's a 50-50. You want to become wise, study, and daven to Hashem. In other words, you have to do your part. It's a natural world. You live in a natural world. Do your part. You want to become wise? You got to study. You're not gonna have a 4.0 grade if you don't study, if you don't put in the hours. And daven. Because you have to recognize, I have to do my part, but I also, within the natural world, I have to recognize Hashem. Who created that reality of within the natural world, turning to Hashem, that Hashem is within the natural world? We discussed last week, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. They related to Hashem through the natural world. Avram looks at the mansion, and he says, there must be someone in charge of this palace, of this mansion. And Hashem says, yeah, it's me. Right? The mansion is the world. He doesn't look beyond it. He sees the world. He sees the world, and he sees Hashem. And B'nai Yisrael said, "We have to turn to Hashem. We have no choice." And Hashem says to them, "That's true. You're right. You've reconnected to the others. You've reconnected to the patriarchs, and so you've reached a point within yourselves where you can now connect to me, where you can incorporate into yourself this level of connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to Hashem. You've earned it." But that's not going to get you across the sea. Why? Because you don't have the merits for the sea to split within the natural framework of the world. The natural framework of the world does not allow you, at the end of the day, you guys still have these idol issues, okay? And the sea says, why should I split? The Egyptians are idolaters, and the Jews are idolaters. So Hashem says, you need to daven. The very first step is you have to daven. You have to recognize that within the natural world, God's running things. It's not just about you. You think you'll flee into the sea. That's not happening. You have to come to a point where you recognize, after all our efforts in the natural world, Hashem is the one in charge of the natural world. We have to daven. Tefillah, davening prayer, is within the confines of the natural world. You can't daven for something which is beyond the natural. Okay, tefillah is always something which is within the natural. You don't find in Shemoneh Esrei anything in tefillah that is supernatural. Okay, it's about things within the natural world. Okay, you want to move beyond tefillah? You want to move beyond the natural into supernatural? That's the next step. And so the first step an angel has to take is to recognize that the natural world that they are breaking out of is not just an Egyptian natural world. It's a natural world of the patriarchs, of the Avos, of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And once they recognize that, then they can break out of that and move beyond that. Okay? So, it's a two-step process. Again, so let's just go over quickly. Egypt is a free gift. It's a loan. Here, take it. You can have it. Okay? But now you have to incorporate it into yourself. It's a freebie. So you're going to spend you're going to spend 6 days, the whole week, you got a Shabbos, you got a freebie. Now you have a whole week to take that and work on it and develop it, and you come to the next Shabbos, to the seventh day. Where are you up to? Have you made it a part of yourself? Have you incorporated it into yourself? Have you recognized that Hashem is in charge of the world? Great. That's not enough. That's the next step. Now you're going to have to take the next step. You're going to have to say, Hashem can do anything even beyond the confines of the natural world. Prayer is not going to help you. There's only one thing you can do at this point, and that is say, nothing is natural. Natural says, if I walk into the sea, I drown. Supernatural says who? Says Hashem. Right? I think I mentioned last week, the epitome of this idea of nothing natural is the story in the Gemara of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. His daughter lit the vinegar one Erev Shabbos on Friday, and she said, oh yeah, I lit vinegar instead of oil. And he said, so? The one who said oil should burn could say vinegar could burn. In other words, oil doesn't burn because it's natural for oil to burn. Oil burns because Hashem wants it to burn. So if Hashem wants vinegar to burn, it could burn also. What's the difference? He lives in a world where it's all the same. It doesn't matter, whatever Hashem wants. And right now, if Hashem wants the vinegar to burn, it could burn the same way. And it did. Because he lived in that world where it was. So, you say, if you walk into water, people don't live in water. People don't live in water. We're going to walk into the water. Who says people can't live in water? Oh, nature. What's nature? It's all going to fall apart. The Bnei Yisrael have to take this plunge and have to go in order for them to reach that level. Okay? And so that's why Hashem says, okay, you daven, fine. That means the fact that you daven, that you turn to me, means you reached a level of recognition that within the natural world, I'm in charge. Now, stop davening because you got to that point. Take the next step. Take the plunge, literally, and go into the sea and move beyond the natural world. Move beyond the constraints. Jump into the sea and see what's going to happen. And rely on nothing but me to save you. And that's what has to happen. Prayer is not going to help. You have to take the next step. So we start off with a question. What kind of game is this? You know, that Hashem tells Bnei Yisrael, I want you to double back and make it look like you're lost, and then power's going to come, and I'll be glorified, and so on and so forth, etc. And then they get to the Yam, and the Yam says, sorry, I can't split. And Bnei Yisrael are caught in a case. They have to be judged. The answer is, we're dealing with two different realities over here. Hashem is telling Bnei Yisrael, I'm going to move you into a world which you experience for a moment on Pesach, but as a freebie, as a gift, I lent it to you. But I need you to move into that world. I need you to get behind the wheel and start driving on that road. Okay? And I need you to drive on that road of supernatural. I need you to be there. How's that going to happen? How are we going to move into that world? So Hashem says that you have to jump in. But how are we going to make it happen? Well, you're going to pull up this whole charade, this whole trick, this whole game. You're going to come to the Yam. And guess what? In the natural world, it's not going to work. You're going to do something which naturally makes absolutely no sense. By you going to that Yam Suf and kind of getting Paro to chase you, convincing Paro that you're lost, and getting him to have a change of heart, and getting him to chase you, within the natural confines of the world makes no sense. You don't have the merits to be saved. It's suicidal. But I want you to do this. You know why? Because I want you to get out of the natural world. I want you to get behind the wheel and get on the road of a whole new path in life, a whole new path in the world. I need you to make that happen. And so Bnei Yisrael go through all the steps and all the motions. And they double back. And Paro says, oh, they're lost. And he chases them. And they come to the Yam. And the Yam says, I won't split. This is all within natural. Angels are part of the natural world that Hashem created. Supernatural is beyond angels. Angels are not part of, we call them supernatural. But in terms of the system that Hashem put into place of how things work, angels are part of that system. Above our heads, but it's part of that system.
So when I think of supernatural, I think of going against the laws of our world, like meaning that you would be able to have gravity in outer space, like
okay.
Going against what is real and concrete and tangible is our natural. So I'm just, this concept of supernatural, it's just
if I could
it's
say,
hard for me. Like it goes beyond fully giving yourself to Hashem. It's like he, you know, the laws of nature, you jump into a sea. It's like a typhoon comes and our community is still here.
Right.
So it goes beyond.
It's beyond. I think the best way to phrase it is it's beyond any normal laws of cause and effect. Anything that I could say, this is why it happened, and the this is why could even be an angel doing his job, but that's still cause and effect. Anything I could say, Hashem created a system. There's cause and effect. If anything I could ascribe it to cause and effect, that's part of natural.
So, just like going back to the point of us, like, and what we're supposed to get out of Pesach for ourselves as individuals and, you know, reaching this level. Like, how does this work with our tefillahs in this?
Okay, I'm going to try to circle back, get back to the point for us at the end. I know I'm short on time.
Is that a good question? Huh? Does that make sense?
No, that's absolutely a fair question. Yeah. So I'm going to try to get back to it. So let me try to get back over to the end because I'm running out of time. So let me try to do this fast. So no, it's not your fault. It's my fault. It's your fault you asked that question. Okay. So Bnei Yisrael have to go through this whole charade, which naturally makes no sense. It really makes no sense at all. It's suicidal. Naturally, they're not going to succeed. They cannot cross the Yam. But Hashem says, I need you to move into that supernatural world, that world beyond cause and effect, where you're right. You're idolaters. They're idolaters. It doesn't matter. I'm in charge, and there's no cause and effect, and it's going to split anyways. It's going to happen anyways. And Bnei Yisrael have to move into that world, have to get onto that road. What happens? The Yam splits. And here they are, and they perceive, what do they perceive? A maidservant saw more at the Yam than Yechezkel saw in his vision of the divine chariot, of the Maaseh Merkava. Okay, the point is that Bnei Yisrael reached a world which was beyond their world. It was beyond the natural. They saw more than Yechezkel, because Yechezkel is a Navi. But Bnei Yisrael saw what Moshe saw. You asked the question earlier, is a Navi part of this world or not? The answer is normally yes. The prophecy Bnei Yisrael had was on the level of Moshe for those moments. It was beyond this world, because that's exactly the world that they tapped into. They tapped into the world that was beyond. The maidservant saw more than Yechezkel, because Yechezkel was kind of locked into this world. So he could get a spark from beyond, but he's still stuck here. Bnei Yisrael, for a few moments, the world broke down, and they saw there's a bigger picture, there's a bigger world beyond the natural cause and effect world of Hashem being in charge of everything, and being beyond all that. But at the end of the day, when all is said and done, they still, although they had incorporated into themselves somewhat, they had not reached the point where they could fully incorporate everything into themselves. They managed to get themselves into the car behind the wheel on that road. But because they left Egypt early when all was said and done, they still hadn't merited to fully incorporate everything into themselves. So they had a perception of a world that they had just moved into, a world much bigger, a world where there's a bigger picture that ultimately leads to Olam Haba, a world beyond this world, and so on and so forth. They saw a bigger picture beyond this natural world. That's the world that we're a part of. We're not here for this world. We're here to move to beyond this world. We're here to move into Olam Haba, to the next world, which is beyond the natural system. Did they move into that world immediately? No. Did they have a perception that they're now on the road moving in that direction? Yes. They had a perception that of being on that highway, so to speak, and down the road they'll eventually get there. Okay? So what do they say? Moshe says, Az Yashir, then we will sing. Bnei Yisrael say, Hashem Yimloch L'Amavar, Hashem will reign forever. Bnei Yisrael, when they had that perception, they saw it, but that Shifcha, that maidservant, did she stop being a maidservant? Did she move beyond her lowly status? She was still a maidservant. She got this perception of something much bigger, something, a world that we're moving into, but it didn't become totally incorporated into themselves. They had merited just, Hashem said, I need to get you onto that road. I need to move you into that world, but you still have a lot of work to do to get to the end of that road. And so here we have the beginning of the process of Tchias HaMesim. The resurrection of the dead is certainly beyond the natural world, right? It's beyond normal cause and effect. It's a world of beyond natural, beyond regular cause and effect, beyond the way Hashem created the world. Where do we see the beginning of that process? At the Yam. At the Yam, Bnei Yisrael got on the road and began that journey towards moving towards there. But they didn't get to the end because they left Egypt early. They weren't able to achieve and accomplish everything they had to. They still have a lot of work to do. And so, but at least they got onto the road at the beginning of the process. And so, Az Yashir, then we will sing down the road, which is a hint to the resurrection of the dead. Hashem Yimloch, Hashem will reign. Have Bnei Yisrael said Hashem Melech, Hashem reigns forever. Meaning, have Bnei Yisrael reached a level where they say, right now we're in a world where there's nothing but Hashem, then they would have been in that world. Why didn't they say it? The answer is they didn't say it because they weren't really there. They saw it. But they're not there yet. Right? When I probably mentioned this, I'm taking a road trip from here to New York. So when I get into that car at the beginning, I'm going to say on my phone, on my map, it says there's New York in 1,850 miles from here. But I'm not there yet. Right? when you're in Chicago halfway through the trip and you're falling asleep, you say, I know where the goal is. I keep going. I keep pushing on. I have a goal I'm moving towards. I know what I'm moving towards. I know there's a purpose. I see mile markers along the way. But right now, I am very tired. Right now, my kids are cranky. Right now, I'm getting cranky. I think it's time for a stop. Okay? That's what's going on right now. But it doesn't mean I lose sight of my goal. right? Because I'm on the road. I see there's a road. I see the mile markers. I see the achievements along the way. So Kriyas Yamsuf was taking Yetzias Mitzrayim, which was a momentary gift, and making it part and parcel of themselves to the extent that they can move forward with it. That they now have the tools and they can now take that world that they saw a flash of on the first night of Pesach and take it into 7 days later into the next Shabbos and say, okay, let's do this. Let's make this happen. But they weren't able to reach the end, but they were able to reach the beginning of the road to move in that direction. Okay? And so that's the idea of Kriyas Yamsuf. And a similar idea by Chizkiya HaMelech. Chizkiya HaMelech, when he defeats the Assyrian army, so the Gemara says, had he sung Shira, he would have become Melech HaMashiach. The idea of Shira always is where you have that perception of, oh, now I see the bigger picture. Shira is always the idea of when the glory of Hashem is revealed, when the natural world falls away, if only for a little while, and you have the opportunity to see a bigger picture beyond the natural world. Okay, and we have these moments in our lives, sometimes in a much smaller sense, of, you know, where all this stuff is happening, and then suddenly you have that aha moment, the sudden epiphany of, oh! Ever happen? Anyone? Right? Okay, now I get it. Okay, and that's the moment of seeing beyond the natural. It all looks so mundane, it all looks so terrible. No. All those pieces, all that terribleness, all those challenges are really a means to creating something much greater than what I was locked into. And that's really what they saw at Kriyas Yamsuf. Does that mean that you reached the end of your challenges and your struggles? No. But it means I know I'm on the road. I know where I'm going. I know I'm in a bigger world than what I thought I was in before. And as soon as that window closes, you're left in the dark again. And so Vayiru Amad Hashem, first Yira, first they have to incorporate into themselves. Then Vayaminu, they believe. What's belief? What is the idea of belief is, I don't see where this is going necessarily. Okay? So why do you believe? Just blind, someone told you? No. The Rambam says, and Rav Shach in a piece expands on this idea, belief is predicated upon facts that you begin with. Okay, if you have enough facts, you have enough information, enough experiences in your life to say this makes sense. I have an understanding, an intellectual understanding of something. Right now, I don't know how this is going to work, but I know that this is what I have to do, even though I have no clue how this is going to work out. That is emunah. Emunah is once I have a structure of experiences built up that I am clear and I'm confident this is the road I have to be on. So even though right now at this moment, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but I've had this experience where you're driving on the highway and you come to a fork in the road and you follow the sign and you say, hey, I saw the sign. It said 80 goes this way. And you're driving and driving and you don't see the 80 marker for like quite a while.
This is in Jersey, right?
In Jersey, yeah, right. This is like somewhere middle of Iowa. And and I'm thinking to myself, did I make a wrong turn? Did I get off at the exit somewhere? No. I say to my wife, who's half asleep, I got off at the right exit, right? No, I'm pretty sure I saw the sign. And you're waiting. You don't turn off because you know that you saw that sign and you're on the right road, but there's this gnawing doubt. And then like finally, you know, there comes the sign. Hey, Baruch Hashem. Okay, that's emunah. Emunah is, like somewhere back there, This all made sense. You're asking me now? I have no idea. But I know that this started somewhere, and I know it's going somewhere. And so Shira is every so often that sign that says, you're on the right road. Look, here's the big picture again. And then closes up again. That's Shira. What's the ultimate? Hashem Yimloich? The final, where you reach the goal, where you know, okay, I was on the road the whole time? That's the end. That's Chiyas HaMeithim. That's Hashem Melech. Hashem reigns, where everything comes together. But right now, Shiras Hayam is the moment of, I'm on the road, and now I get to see that moment in my life where I have the sign. I moved into that world. Till now, I was just in the world where I recognized the natural world, Hashem is running things. Tefillah, I daven, I put in my effort. This cause and effect, I can put all together, it makes sense. The next level is Hashem is like, hey, here I'm giving you a bigger picture, you have to follow this road, and you're going to come to points in your life where you're not going to see anything. Okay? But that Shira is the moment where it's going to carry you further, where you'll have that moment of, I'm still on the right road. It still makes sense. Vayaminu b'Hashem u'b'Moshe Avdoi. That was the next step. They believed. because the belief is that even though I don't see where this is going, but I know I'm on the right road. I know I'm in the right world. I know where I am. I know where I'm going, even if I can't see it right now, but I have that sense because I had that moment, that aha moment, a little while ago. That is the seventh day of Pesach. It's a day where I'm not there. I haven't incorporated everything into myself, but this is where the road is going, and I'm on that road. Okay? And I'll just leave you with one thought. This world is compared to an ocean. The next world is like dry land. Because an ocean, you don't really live in an ocean. People go out to sea to make money. I'm sorry, I'm way over time. If you have to leave, please feel free to leave. I apologize. People go out to sea. The Gemara, the Torah always talks about the sea as an opportunity for people to go to engage in business. People go to Medina Hayam to engage in business and commerce and so on and so forth. Boats and ships are always described, almost always described in terms of Zebulun lives on the seashore, he's the merchant guy, right? And so on and so forth. You go out to sea, you don't belong in the sea, but you're there because you need to bring stuff home. So Hashem, in a sense, cast us out into the sea. If you know the Eighth Day song, which was borrowed from the Chabad song. Anyone listen to the Eighth Day here? No? Okay. There's a Chabad song called Fort Ayidla in Ashifala. There's a little Jew floating in a ship. Yeah? And he calls out and he says, save me! My ship is sinking. Hashem puts us in this boat in this world, and we're floating along, and we're here to gather goods to bring back home. This world is the Yam. The next world is the dry land that we have to bring the goods home. What does Hashem do? Bnei Yisrael go b'soy chayam b'yabosha, in the sea on the dry land. In other words, they're in the sea, but they're on the dry land. So where are they? In the sea or in the dry land? The answer is, you're in a natural world. You don't see beyond the sea. You don't see where this is all going. I'm stuck in the middle of the sea. There's water on all sides of me. How am I getting out of this? But Hashem says, but I'm going to give you dry land. For a moment, I'm going to give you a glimpse of the dry land over there. I'm going to put it into this world. You're going to walk on the dry land within the sea for a few moments. Bnei Yisrael tap into that world for a few moments of bringing Olam Haba, bringing beyond the natural, into the natural. They went within the sea on the dry land. Okay? For a few moments they were given a glimpse of a bigger world than the Yam, than the sea that we are stuck in. And we need to realize in our lives also that Pesach is that night of moving beyond the natural world. By the time you get to the seventh day of Pesach, you say, okay, what do I do with all this now? You have a whole Pesach. The rest of Pesach is to incorporate that, to think about that, to build that, and then you come to the seventh day of Pesach, it's to make that enough of a part of yourself that you can move on. Beyond that, then you start Sfiras HaOmer, and that's a whole, I'm way out of time, but Sfiras HaOmer is the process then of really building it into a bigger reality called Matan Torah, but we'll have to talk about that some other time. Next Monday night, anybody? No? No one for Monday night? Okay, so, but that is the idea of Kriyas Yamsuf. It's the ability that in our own lives, when we don't necessarily have the glimpse of where am I going, what am I doing, to know that we have those moments in our lives where we get a glimpse of the bigger picture and to use that to move us forward, to propel us forward into the moment where we don't have it. That's Emuna. Emuna is taking what you had before into the darkness and being able to use it. And Kriyas Yamsuf created that world that we can lock into. And that is, I think, a large part of what the seventh day of Pesach is about. Okay? Does that answer it? Okay. Yes, go ahead.
I have a question, but I don't want to hold anyone.
I already invited everyone to leave before, so I will not be insulted if you walk out
so,
on me.
First of all, it's very good to understand that, you know, like both, you know, like, so the, you know, like, Jews, when, you know, like, they kind of, like, criticized that, had they, you know, like, said, you know, like, Melech right now, And, you know, like, you always think that this is kind of like their mistake. They haven't done something, that this is like... But
right.
Otherwise, you know, like, they were quite realistic. You know, like, this is where they're, like, the point they reach. And they
exactly.
Understand it. The same with, like, Melech Hizkiyahu, because I always thought, had he, like, said, and, you know, like, you feel kind of like that he didn't see something, he didn't...
If you would have asked me, I would have told him that he should do it, right? Yeah.
But he really didn't understand. He was quite realistic.
Exactly.
He was where he was. But, you know, like, so, that is really good. My question is, you know, like, what Shoshana asked also bothers me, and everything you explained makes sense. The only thing that still doesn't make sense, that word, may I borrow?
May I borrow.
So, I wonder, in Hebrew, what is the word in Hebrew? Because sometimes... The translation, and sometimes...
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes, you know, like Hebrew word can mean this, this, this.
Right,
this.
But in the, I mean, we can fight. I'm not an expert in Hebrew. What?
No.
V'yishalu. V'yishalu, they should borrow. No, it's very literal, borrow. It's the idea of borrow, but at that point, I mean, let me. V'yishalu? No, they borrow. No, v'yishalu is a term of borrowing. Halva'a, she'ila, doesn't mean to ask, means to borrow as a person. Halva'a, okay. The term halva'a is when you're lending me money, I'm going to spend the money, and I owe you the money back, different money I'm going to pay back. Halva'a is where I'm going to use what you give me and give you back something else. A she'ila is where I'm going to return what you give me. She'ila. I'm going to borrow, meaning I will give it back. Okay? So let me add one more layer to your question, okay? And that is this. B'nai Yisrael, Moshe tells Paro, we're leaving for 3 days. That's what he tells Paro the whole time. We're leaving for 3 days. No, that was the whole time. He said 3 days. And in fact, Rashi said that after 3 days, Paro sent messengers with them, agents, and they went back and said, 3 days are up. They're not coming back. And Paro gave chase. So the answer is both had the same answer. At that point, what B'nai Yisrael were up to, it was a borrowing. In other words, they weren't at the level to keep
they
it.
They thought they were borrowing.
You know, again, it's the same idea. It's the same idea as Hashem Yimloch. We're going to be very realistic where we're up to. Right now, all this is a borrowing. Because right now, we're coming back in 3 days. Because right now, we're not at the level to get out for more than 3 days. Right now, B'nai Yisrael are still tied to Egypt. They have to come back. Things may change. This is a developing story. It's a developing story. We'll see what happens. But right now, B'nai Yisrael are leaving for 3 days and they're coming back. Now, it happens to be, after 3 days, B'nai Yisrael worked on themselves and they developed and they incorporated. They moved a little further away from Mitzrayim, a little further away from Mitzrayim. You know, they're cutting the cords and there's the showdown at the Yom Suf.
But you know, I want to say something about that, and I think it's something we don't understand.
It's a chol. I have not seen. I have not seen an indication. I have not seen an indication of that.
Yeah, this. How can you have the word chase and there's many words in there in that pasuk to show that they were actually in awe of Am Yisrael at that time, and so we don't know what their mindset is that they gave it to them. In other words, maybe B'nai Yisrael were on the Madrega that they knew they didn't. They weren't yet getting it. But the intention that the Mitzrayim in turn gave it to them was not to get it back.
Well,
okay, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. But again,
the whole thing is like we don't know what's in a person's mind, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows that at that point, B'nai Yisrael thought they were borrowing it, but they didn't want it back. They actually were giving it to them very freely up to okay. Will. And actually, if you listen to Rabbi Foreman on that pasuk, you're going to see what he says about the Ehu on there. About how they felt about
B'nai Yisrael
at that time.
Okay, but you know, like, then my question is, you know, like, good for the Egyptians, you know, like, they were giving it away for good, but you know, like,
why didn't they ask honestly?
And I understand that at that point they thought they will be returning, but you know, like, the 10, you know, like, we're always reading, you know, like, the 10, you know, like, martyrs on the, you know, like, Tisha B'Av, you know, like, that, you know, like, emperor came back and said, you know, like, you kidnapped, like, the, I mean, just, brothers kidnapped, and nobody paid for that, and what the Jewish law says, okay, you have to do that, and so, my question is, Jews gave the word, and at that time, they completely believed they were borrowing it, completely.
Okay.
You know, like, Egyptians wanted to give away.
Okay, so let's say they believed they were borrowing at that point.
Right.
But then it changed later on. At a later point, they became entitled to keep it. Why? They have to come back and I don't know that they have to come back and apologize. In a sense, they had a right. And really, the Gemara talks about this. Centuries later, the Gemara says what?
They weren't finished.
Centuries later, there's a story in the Gemara about where the Egyptians came to Alexander and said, all the Jews owe us money. And they sent Gevir ben Pesisa. And he said, we owe you the money? No, how many years did we work for you? How many people? Right, let's get out the house. So in other words, technically they were entitled. Now what's the problem? So call a spade a spade, right? Be upfront about it. The answer is at that point they weren't entitled to it yet. So they can't, at that point, the same way Chizki is not going to sing Shira, if he's not there, they're not going to say, give it to us, we deserve it, if they didn't deserve it yet. But when they got to the Yom Suf, they deserved it. So at that point, they could tell the Egyptians, okay, we deserve it. And that's why, by the way, I didn't have time for this, but I'll say it now since I'm here anyways, and I miss Meir. So I'll just make the point. So that's why at the sea, you find a very strange thing. In Egypt, Moshe had to beg them to take the money, and they didn't want it. At the sea, Moshe had to drag them away from the seashore where they're collecting all the money. What changed? In Egypt, you didn't like it, and suddenly here you do? The answer is because when they got to the sea, they had moved up. So now they deserved it. Now they felt it themselves that, to
it's
some
like
degree,
also, you,
to
you
some level.
Me, you,
no,
you
that wasn't the idea.
Home.
Although,
I
that was...
At a literal time.
No, although the Medrash does say that, they went over and said, hey, there's the guy who beat me up. You know, because the Medrash says that Hashem cast all the bodies onto the seashore so that they could see them. And it says that they saw their oppressors, and a Jew would say, oh, there's that Egyptian who beat me, who oppressed me. So it's like a so what is it like? It's a revenge kind of a situation, you know? Huh? Exactly. The point is, they saw the final picture. Why did we go through this? Why was it able to be? Here's the final. In other words, it wasn't a personal vindication. It was a vindication in a bigger picture of recognizing how everything fit together. So the way I understand it, think about it. But the way I understand it is that initially they were very realistic. All we could do right now is borrow it. Really, in a sense, they can make a demand in terms of their slavery, but from a spiritual sense, they're not entitled to it spiritually yet. 6 days later at the Yam, they have earned the right to keep that money and more. They're going to get even more by the Yam Suf. And that they're going to keep. Okay? I'll just point out one other thing. The verse that is used by the Medrash to discuss the money of Egypt and the money of the sea, it refers to the money of Egypt as silver and the money of the sea as gold. Silver is always affiliated with chesed. Kesef comes from the word nichsef nichsafta. When you have a longing for something, a love, right? Nichsef nichsafta is a longing. The word kesef has to do with a longing or a love for another individual, a longing out of love. That's kesef. Zahav is always affiliated with din, with judgment. It represents fire, which is judgment. It's a similar color. That's zahav. In other words, in Egypt they got kesef. Through chesed, through kindness, through out of love, Hashem gave it to them. They didn't earn it. By the Yam, it was zav, it was gold. They earned it in din. They deserved it. They got to a point where they were entitled to it. And so Bnei Yisrael had to be dragged away. What are they? They don't know how much money do they need already. That's not the point. The point is that they needed all this gold because there was a purpose to make a Mishkan. Now, tangentially, even with the Kriyas Yam, if they hadn't totally refined themselves, and so, hence, there was that opening for the golden calf where they failed, but then eventually came back. Yeah, well, gold is because of that din. Yeah, because there's an element of din over there, of judgment. So, that's always been my, not always, that has been my understanding after working through this, of this parsha. You can think about it, you could agree or disagree, but I have not seen that it's a chok. I have not seen that it's a chok.
I think it's an okay. Element in arrogance, because you want to be... I'm
losing
my
stand. Okay, I'll tell you what. You think about it over Pesach, you let me know after Pesach. It has to, I'll give you 7 days to incorporate it into yourself, and you'll come back to me, you'll let me know.
So the reason I'm losing my stand is because originally we looked at it very straight. You know, like, well, money, candelabra, whatever. You know, right. Very straight. Then when you explain more about, you know, like sparks, and, you know, like silver and kiddush sparks, of silver,
right.
And then silver and gold. You know, like, you speak Hebrew, right? So, you know, like, I heard somewhere there's, like, another word that kesef means the means. You know, like, in Russian it's sredstva, the means of something, reaching something. Another word that has the same shortage. And zahav, like, gold means kind of like the goal that has been reached, something like that.
Okay, I'm not sure, but very,
well,
very possible.
I need to look up. I know the book where I read it. So I need
okay.
To look.
You let me know if you find it. Please let me know. I'd like to see
it. But it means that we shouldn't think about it like in our, you know, like monetary regimes where we feel, but like, rather that, as you were explaining,
there's a higher purpose
in like, you know, like, and, you know, like sparks of kedusha and this. So in this case, it is not something that I would feel really like bad about. So,
okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh. I'm going to go on a long drive trip.